This is the big fight, and I'm Maria Shakil. The world's oldest democracy, the largest economy, and the world's biggest military power is going to polls. The United States will elect a new president in less than a week. Former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris are locked in a fierce battle. It is considered one of the most significant elections in U.S. history. Tensions are high as the nation battles a cost of living crisis while simultaneously arming and aiding two wars happening in different parts of the world. One of the major issues on which voters are deciding their mandate is immigration policy. In fact, a study of the Pew Research Center showed that about 6 in 10 voters, that is 61%, say immigration is very important to their vote. It is of particular importance to Republican voters specifically, as 82% of Donald Trump supporters say it is a very important issue compared to 39% of Kamala Harris supporters who think the same. The fear that immigrants will displace workers, bring crime to the streets of America, and be a drain on services also matters. One thing is clear. This election polarizes the world as much as it does the United States. Will Kamala Harris carry on in Biden's footsteps with her conviction that in, and I quote her, these unsettled times, it is clear America cannot retreat? Or will it be Donald Trump with his hope, and I quote him now, Americanism, not globalism, will lead the way? We live in a world where the value of U.S. global influence is under question. Regional powers are going their own way, autocratic regimes are making their own alliances, and the devastating wars in Gaza, Ukraine, and elsewhere are raising uncomfortable questions about the significance, relevance, and value of Washington's role. So these elections are a pivotal moment in the U.S. history, which could have massive implications for how the country is governed and for the future of the post-war order that Washington has helped build. Donald Trump's election campaign has been about his messages of American carnage and America first, and it has led to a first sustained debate about the United States' role since the end of the Cold War. And that's what we discuss on The Big Fight tonight. Let me bring in my guests now. And it's a high-powered panel which is joining us from across the U.S. We have John Rosamondo, commentator on U.S. national security, joining me from Washington, D.C. Professor David K. Johnston is professor at Rochester Institute of Technology. He's also the author of The Making of Donald Trump. We have Matt Klink, who is a Republican strategist, Jonah Blank, former advisor to President Joe Biden. We also have Stephen Ezell, Vice President, Global Innovation Policy, ITIF. Professor Zenia Bahil is professor and political analyst and someone who has a keen eye on the Indian diaspora. We have Nicholas Nugent, British journalist, joining me from London. And we also have Meenakshi Ahmed, author of A Matter of Trust, U.S.-India Relations from Truman to Trump. And Kamal Sibal, former Indian Foreign Secretary, will be joining me shortly. I'm going to begin with you, Professor Johnston. What are the issues on voters' minds? Is it healthcare, education, or immigration and foreign policy?
I think the most important issue is going to turn out to be the Supreme Court decision that revoked Roe versus Wade, which created a right under certain circumstances to have an abortion. We've seen this turn out huge numbers of voters at the polls. We've seen it motivate many people who were not registered to vote to vote. And while that's not being discussed very much in the news, I think it's the most important issue. Immigration is clearly an issue, especially in some of the states. There are also some phony issues here. For example, inflation is now at a rate of 2.1%. The target of the Federal Reserve is 2%. That is essentially the same. The inflation rate right now is well below the post-World War II average of 3.5%. The U.S. economy, according to The Economist magazine, which is as sober a publication as exists in the world, is the envy of the world, with job creation, rising wages, increased domestic investment. But a lot of Americans don't know that. A lot of Americans believe wrongly that we're in a recession.
Okay. And one view certainly is that this is a referendum on the entire global trade system. So how will it really impact the voters' choice if they have that sense of big responsibility here, Matt Klink?
Well, I'd like to start by saying to the professor, thank you for that academic treatise on how great things are. Unfortunately, voter sentiment doesn't match what you say. And typical Democratic response is, oh, we're just not communicating effectively. Under Biden and Harris, everything costs more. Everything across the board. Families are suffering. On the global stage, the world is in a markedly more dangerous place because of 4 years of weakness from the Biden and Harris administration. One need only look at the Ukraine, where it's pretty interesting that Ukraine has been attacked twice, once under Barack Obama and once under Joe Biden. Israel is infinitely weaker. America is less respected around the world. And look, if you want 4 more years of weakness, then vote for Kamala Harris, because that's what you're going to get. I think that the American voters are pretty sober, and they realize that 4 years of Biden and Harris has been a failure, and they're going to enact some fundamental change come Tuesday of next week.
Okay, Professor Zinnia, weigh in on this, particularly the point that has been made about what Donald Trump said, that tariff is a very beautiful word in the dictionary, more beautiful than love and more beautiful than respect. You know, many say that this would hit more than $3 trillion in U.S. imports and probably cause multiple trade wars as other countries will retaliate with their own tariff policies.
Yes. What you're talking about is, right, the consumption tax. And the United States will not be the first economy to actually implement that if at all Trump comes to power and is able to successfully implement that, right? There have been other economies in the world, including Canada and other developed countries, which have implemented that. But you also need to understand that if that is implemented, it will significantly increase the cost of basic necessities for consumers within the United States, right? That plan itself can impact families, can impact middle-class families. So it's something to consider. And Trump has always been an advocate of increasing tariffs, right? Increasing tariffs from goods coming from China, coming from India, right? He's often stated that countries such as India, countries such as China have taken advantage of, more lenient trade policies in the United States, as he's called it. So the sentiment about inflation is definitely, you know, echoed, especially in the state of Pennsylvania, which is a battleground state. Voters in various counties have talked about inflation, how that has impacted, you know, the middle class budget overall. And it's a very big issue, right? And can Trump solve it or can Kamala Harris solve it? That's an interesting question. Do want to add some balance here, right? Economists at Wharton stated that Kamala Harris's plan, the opportunity economy, may also lead to a bigger deficit than what America is currently battling, right? The overall deficit is over $34 trillion, if I'm not mistaken. But we also see a strong economy right now, right? When my fellow professor had talked about, we do see a strong economy. The U.S. economy just added about 12,000 jobs. So there are those pluses, there are those minuses. But overall, it's about how the middle class is going to pick a candidate. And inflation, of course, abortion, a lot of these issues are going to impact the voter sentiment, especially in the swing states.
Okay. So then, you know, what started as an election, Meenakshi Ahmad, where Kamala Harris, when her name was announced, what was at a decisive gap between the two candidates has turned out to be, as the early voting continues, to be one of the closest elections in American history. I mean, something that nobody is taking a chance and predicting it. And it's also a sense that it's almost like a dead heat. Why do you think it's becoming such a close contest?
Well, I think that there's no question that it's a very closely contested election. And I don't think that any of us is in a position to try and guess what the outcome might be. I'd like to sort of make a point here. It is unprecedented that there's never been a situation in any election in the U.S. where close to 50 Republicans, Republicans, some of whom worked for the president or the candidate, including his chief of staff, including defense secretaries, including people in the military, and his vice president, have denounced the candidate and said he's unfit to govern and that he is a danger to democracy and a danger to the Constitution of the U.S. This is unprecedented. So whatever people may have thought of Joe Biden, or that he was too old, or that the people were covering up some of his disabilities, what we have seen recently is unprecedented. Okay. The U.S. set up an architecture of alliances in the world that basically kept Europe and much of the world safe for close to 50, after World War II. And almost every president, Republican and Democrat, subscribed to those alliances. Donald Trump, when he was president, upended that. Hmm. And I think there are many people in the military and surrounding him who are very, very concerned that when he comes in, and if he has a Republican Congress or a Republican Senate that doesn't have guardrails and doesn't have the people that he had before, like Kelly and you know, Mattis and all these other generals who cared about those alliances, that, you know, he might just put the world in a much more dangerous place, with all due respect to
Matt Klink to respond to that. Here is a view that is coming in that, Donald Trump is increasingly isolated in his own team. So within the Republicans, among the Republicans, he may have been the choice because they did not have any. But now he's seen as this dangerous figure who's not good for the world and America. Matt, will you respond to that, please?
Oh, excuse me. I did not hear that. Well, look, if you want to talk about democracy, Kamala Harris got zero votes in 2020. She was given the nomination because they had an inarticulate, mentally addled Joe Biden on stage. So, and Donald Trump has over 94% of the Republican vote. So he's going to overwhelmingly win the Republicans. He is clearly expanding the voter rolls. Young African American men and young Latino men are flowing toward him. They always talk about the gender gap. Married women will ultimately end up voting for Donald Trump, and he's pushing the envelope. He's now going to states like New Mexico and Virginia, expanding the voter universe. Kamala Harris has pulled her money out of the swing state of North Carolina. Her campaign is in retreat, and I think you're going to see, I don't think it's going to be that close on election day. I think Donald Trump is going to win. We won't know for 3 or 4 days afterward, just because some states count votes slowly. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be that close because Kamala Harris has not sealed the deal yet.
Okay, John, come in now, and let's talk about...
I respond to that, please?
Yes, please. Go ahead, ma'am.
Yes. I really think Matt needs to get his facts right. I think he definitely speaks, based on a very polarized opinion. And that kind of gives you a sense of the elections here in the United States, right? When he talks about married women, right, putting that tag, thank you, sir, but really don't like the way you mentioned, you know, the term married women. But any which way, Kamala Harris did not win in 2020. And that's a classic example of why women of color and women who seek positions of power are discriminated against here in the United States, and why racism is within the fabric of our society, right? Because women have to be given opportunity. Women deserve opportunities. Women need to be given opportunities, and unfortunately,
absolutely,
they aren't, right?
Absolutely.
To run for the president of the United States.
You know, I have to bring in others also, Zinia, because there are a number of panelists who haven't even expressed their opening comments. So let me bring in John now. John, you know, moving away from bread and butter issues, there was this sense that did America discuss too much of immigrants? And that was because of the fear that was generated by Donald Trump. So kitchen table issues were put on the back burner, quite literally. So, you know, let's look at what Donald Trump actually said. So he sought to conjure up images of criminal immigrants eating dogs and maybe also cats. While both the sides, be it Kamala Harris or Donald Trump, they have spoken about immigration and tough policies which are needed. But when it comes to enforcement, Donald Trump has gone several miles ahead, and he has also spoken about perhaps the largest deportation ever in American history. John, if you heard me.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm having difficulty hearing. I would say that we're not talking about immigrants. You know, an immigrant is somebody who follows our laws, who goes and applies for asylum at a U.S. consulate, or someone who comes in legally. We're talking about millions of criminal invaders who have been ginned up by places like Venezuela and its intelligence services, and also by criminal gangs across Latin America that have come in under this administration. You have Eric Adams, the Democrat mayor of New York City, who lambasted Kamala Harris last year for lack of leadership. The social services of our major cities have been overwhelmed by this tide of criminal migration into this country. And you have gangs like Transnicaragua that the president likes to talk about that have brought them in here. We have a failure of this administration, or rather a decision by this administration, mm-hmm. to let unvetted individuals, some people say as many as 20 million, into this country. Now, if you want to come to this country, we are a nation of immigrants. Follow our laws, do things according to the rule of law. A lot of Trump supporters are immigrants themselves. And, recent immigrants, people from Lebanon, Afghanistan, India, for example, Latin America, who all support Trump. But they do not support people who come in, who cut in line. The best way to describe these individuals that Trump wants to deport is they're immigration cheats. They cheated, gotten bumped in line.
But then the question is that is he closing America and the American dream? Stephen Ezell, Harris and Trump are offering competitive narratives on what they see is current state of affairs in America. Trump is talking about America's international perception on decline. Kamala Harris is redirecting the question about the U.S. economy whenever there has been a discussion, particularly with regards to Trump's China policy. My question is, how did the foreign policy claims on both the sides take center stage in an election that is focused on Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania?
Well, one point I think it's critically important for your viewers in India to recognize is that this entire election comes down to seven states: Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Georgia, North Carolina, Arizona, and Nevada. What happens in the other 43 states does not matter. They're going one way or the other. So as we talk about the issues in the discussion today, it's critically important to understand what issues are most important to voters in these particular states. Now, overall, Gallup says that for American voters, economy is the most important issue, and Trump has a 9-point lead over Harris there. Now, with regard to foreign policy in China, that's an interesting question vis-a-vis these particular states. Certainly in the Midwest, those three states are Rust Belt states. They've been hit very hard by unbalanced trade with China. We know from economists like David Otter at MIT, the China syndrome finds that the U.S. lost 2.5 million manufacturing jobs in the past decade alone due to unbalanced trade with China. So it's quite likely that the candidate that is able to show that they'd be tougher on China trade policy issues will have an advantage, particularly in those Midwest states. The issue of fracking, I think, will be vitally important to Pennsylvania as well. And then when you look at Arizona and Nevada and Georgia, I think immigration will become a critically important voter issue for those states as well. But overall, interestingly, I think despite the state of the world we see today with the challenges in Ukraine, obviously in the Middle East, China, Taiwan, I think domestic national issues will still be overall abortion as well will be the deciding determinant on Americans' minds when they cast their votes on Tuesday.
Okay, so Nicholas, now let's look at the world picture, because as we said, that this is an election which the world is watching, who will be leading America because of the influence that U.S. has on the rest of the world. I was reading this article of someone in who covers Europe, and the sense was that U.S. election feels like an end of an era, whatever the outcome, and Trump's victory is either a nightmare or a gift. So how is UK viewing this election?
Well, I don't think I'm going to answer that question directly because I don't know, like nobody else knows. But I will tell you how the election is being perceived here.
Yes.
It's being covered like no election before. Maybe that's a slight exaggeration, but we're getting wall-to-wall coverage of the American election. Why? Because it matters, as you quite rightly say. It matters in Britain, it matters in Europe, it matters throughout the world. Why does it matter to us? Well, one reason already alluded to by Meenakshi Ahmed was about alliances, because America provides the security that much of the world depends on. I don't think that's overstating the case. It's definitely not overstating the case with regard to Europe, where NATO has kept the peace since the Second World War. Again, I choose my words carefully, but I don't think I'm overstating it. And Europe is in a critical state at the moment with an active war of coming on for 3 years. It's a time when we really need security in Europe like never before, or more acutely than ever before. So we care about American security. We care about the security America provides. So we're very anxious to see this election completed and a new regime take over, whichever one it is. Now, you don't need me to tell you that Kamala Harris appears to be more committed to overseas alliances than Donald Trump, and there are big question marks being raised in Europe about Donald Trump's commitment to Europe. I'll say no more than that. The rest of the speakers are speaking from the United States, and they would know better than me. But I'm telling you the issues that concern us.
Yes, absolutely.
I'll take that one stage further.
Yes. Go ahead, Nicholas.
Well, I'll take that one stage further and say we're also concerned about stability. And the election is really quite destabilizing. It may be destabilizing in the States. It's destabilizing in Europe as well. Because it's a long, drawn-out process, which, frankly, won't be completed until late in January. And we find that a little strange. Bear in mind that, like you in India, we in Britain had an election this year in July, and the result of the election was enacted within 24 hours, quite remarkably. So we like smooth democracies where the change of regime takes place quickly. And I'm bound to say that's not the case in America. And I only have to say 6th of January for you to know what I'm referring to. There are reasons for concern about the long delay, at least I'm concerned about the long delay between the election result coming in perhaps late next week and the inauguration on the 20th of January, I think it is. So that's my second thing. But I will just say one more thing, which is economic. The United States economy also has an effect around the world. In other words, it's a sort of stabilizing influence. So we like to see a stable economy. So if I were having a vote, and I don't, economic matters would be high. But
yes.
I'm not backing either candidate. I don't have a vote. I just want to tell you how we're perceiving that in Britain, and I suspect in Europe and even beyond. I haven't even mentioned Taiwan, because we're talking about alliances.
Absolutely.
And I think security in the Far East is an issue for which we're all also all looking to the new regime in America, the new government, to take a lead on security issues in the Far East.
Yes. Nicholas, continue to be with us. That's actually very well put, because the concerns in Europe and UK and the rest of the world, because, Jonah, the question is, will the US continue to play a dominant role in global affairs? Or will other nations like China or maybe India step up to fill the power vacuum? Because experts are of the opinion and weighing on this, that the US needs to redefine its global role and prioritize what it looks at in terms of its policy. And that is the reason why, you know, that election, many say, matters massively for Russia and Ukraine. There is a sense among the Ukrainians that Trump, in case if he gets elected, will force a quicker deal to end this war. And on the other hand, there is a view that the American support for Ukraine could decline under a Harris presidency.
Well, you're absolutely right.
No, that's for Jonah Blank. I'm coming to you in a bit. Yeah.
You're absolutely right. The election will determine whether the U.S. is to remain a reliable ally and a reliable partner to its friends around the world. And Donald Trump has already made abundantly clear that his friends, the countries he will support, are Putin's Russia, are Kim Jong-un in North Korea, are President Xi in China. He likes dictators. He said that time and time and time again. But this election really is about something even more fundamental. Hmm. It's about whether America is going to be a country of people who look like me, or it will also be a place for people who look like my two biracial kids. Kamala Harris embodies this. Her ancestry is Indian and Jamaican, and she's thoroughly American. And that's the vision that she presents, where all Americans are a part. That's not what Donald Trump is saying when he says, let's get back to an earlier generation. He's foregrounded immigration. It's not because he dislikes immigrants. Two-thirds of his wives are immigrants. But they're not the kind of immigrants that Donald Trump wants to see as thoroughly American. This is really about, is America a white and male country, or do all Americans have a role in it? And if we give that up, we're no longer a democracy. And that affects everyone of every race, of living in every state, because America cannot be a democracy and a basically just a place for people who look like Donald Trump. That's what this is going to be decided on.
I can see two people smiling and John being in complete disagreement. John, would you express your views on that?
Well, let's put it this way. My Democrat friend is creating a huge straw man. This campaign has spent a large amount of resources by employing Massad Boulos, who's Tiffany Trump, his daughter's father-in-law, to do a very successful outreach campaign to the Arab American community, to the Afghan community, to Muslim communities across America. The president has also worked hard to obtain the highest approval of any Republican among Black voters. The idea that this is some sort of white supremacist campaign is something that is complete, not misinformation, disinformation on the part of the Democrats, aimed at scaring their suburban white base against supporting President Trump. As far as the U.S. standing in the world is concerned, President Trump supports the alliances. He just doesn't want the United States to be, the only main partner in, NATO, in an alliance in Asia. If you talk to, I'm very close to former leaders of the Afghan military, when they said when we were in NATO was in Afghanistan, it was the United States, then you had the other countries. President Trump has been pushing the NATO members to increase their contribution to the alliance beyond the 2% that was set, I believe, at the summit in 2006. And Poland has become the main embodiment in Europe of Trump's strategy. I mean, Trump was lambasted by the Democrats when he was like talking about moving troops out of Germany. Germany is not the front line. We saw under this administration appeasing the Iranians from day one by ending our support for the Saudi and Emirati war against the Houthis. Now we're paying the price in terms of shipping. We saw the disaster in Afghanistan that led to the disaster in Ukraine when Biden said that he would might not intervene if it was a minor incursion to Ukraine. We've seen Kamala Harris at the same time standing side by side with Joe Biden on every major decision. She said she was the last person in the room on Afghanistan.
Okay.
I mean, I think that everything that the Democrats say about President Trump is disinformation. I mean, this is the party who talks about disinformation when everything it says about President Trump is false.
John, that's
distorted,
actually the charge
taken out of context,
that Donald Trump faces. That entire campaign has been about disinformation. But the larger question is also of what happens, Meenakshi Ahmed, if the next administration, how will it really approach the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? And what implications do you think it will have for regional stability? Because the debate certainly has highlighted differences between Harris and Trump on the issue. We have heard it during the entire campaign so far.
Well, look, in terms of the election, we can all look at the polls and we see that foreign policy is just right at the bottom of everyone's priority. It leads with Roe v. Wade and immigration and then inflation. So, you know, U.S. elections are always driven by domestic issues. So foreign policy is, to be quite honest, right at the bottom of the agenda. So this election is not going to be driven by foreign policy. So let me just make that quite clear. In terms of the Middle East, you know, Donald Trump had put in place a Muslim ban. I think I have no way of substantiating this, but I think if you do an overall survey of Muslim Americans, I think most of them probably view him as being not particularly friendly towards Muslim countries or Muslims. But he has tried to backpedal that during the election. I think that in my personal view is Joe Biden is very grounded in the old, you know, support Israel at any cost. And that is, he has always been a very firm supporter of Israel. I think Benjamin Netanyahu has run circles around him. I don't think their Mideast policy has been effective.
Okay.
And I think that Kamala Harris's approach is going to be quite different.
Okay. And Stephen Azell, I've been looking at one of the quotes of Donald Trump during his campaign, and he said that it's time to go back to peace and stop killing people. But he also reportedly, as is being reported by certain sections of media, told Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu to do what you have to do. So the question is, can he really be the peacemaker? Or do you think America, for having taken its side, cannot play that role anymore?
Well, I think we can look at the last 4 years and see a world that was at peace before the previous administration took over. I do think that the nature of our withdrawal from Afghanistan signaled a stepping back of U.S. leadership on the global stage that did subsequently invite individuals from Putin to the team at Hamas to feel that their actions in international affairs could be more unencumbered because of the stepping back of the U.S. presence. So, you know, I think the Biden approach has unleashed some of the instability we have seen in the last 4 years. Now, I think the question is, can Trump come in and be a stabilizing force as before? Yeah, and I think he could have good relationships with key partners in that region, with Israel, with Saudi Arabia, with Egypt. How we will broker a lasting peace in that region has certainly been a challenge for generations, for multiple American administrations. But I think first to come to a resolution of the hostilities and then to lead to a path forward, I think that is something a Trump administration is capable of doing.
And Stephen, are you sensing that the results will be out soon? Or as one of the panelists pointed out, and that was Nicholas Nugent, that we really do not know how events will be playing out, given how polarizing this entire campaign would be. Do you think it'll spill over also during the counting, because it has become a very, very close election?
Well, you know, there are some states that are able to close the books very quickly after an election. And there are others like Pennsylvania and Arizona that have processes that tend to take some time longer. I think given how close this election is going to be and that Pennsylvania and Arizona are two states involved, I do not think the world will go to bed on November 5th knowing who the American president will be.
So there won't be another episode which was really shameful, which was 6th of January. That's the sense here. So, Professor David Kaye, let's start wrapping up this discussion. And I'm going to begin with you. What will you be watching out for in the next few days before 4th?
Well, I think the most important thing will be turnout.
What a turnout,
Kamala
yes.
Harris will win the popular vote by millions of votes, but we don't elect by popular vote. We elect through the Electoral College. And unfortunately, this is really an election about the character of the American people. Do you want to elect a felon and a con artist? And understand that I'm the only one on this panel who knows Donald and knows him well. I've known him and talked to him for hundreds of hours over the last 36 years. He is a con artist. He has been associated with criminals, including one of the biggest cocaine traffickers in America his entire life. He's a convicted felon. He's running against a prosecutor. I don't know what could be more clear about American politics than the prosecutor versus the felon. So this is really an election on who are the American people. Do they believe in the ideals of the American Constitution, or do they want to throw it away and elect an authoritarian who has said he will turn the U.S. military on the American people, he will use the Justice Department to prosecute people, who says that people like me as a journalist should not be able to write stories about him unless he approves of them, something he has said consistently for the whole 36 years that I've known Donald. And that's really what we're going to learn
but
from
Professor
the outcome
Johnson,
of this vote.
Weren't all these issues also at play 4 years ago? Of course, at that time, Donald Trump did not win. It was Joe Biden who was elected. But it wasn't really such a close contest that we are seeing. I mean, there has been a decline in Kamala Harris's popularity. Maybe she got some narratives wrong.
I don't think the polls are particularly reliable. And here's a major reason, as explained to me by one of America's leading pollsters. Fewer than 1 in 100 people who answer the telephone will answer the questions. And so, well, you can have a poll that appears to have the right number of married women between 25 and 45 and other demographic groups. There's some kind of self-selection going on here. There's been an enormous additional number of people who've turned out to register and have turned out to vote early. There are very large numbers of Republican women who are voting early. That's why I think Dobbs is a very important factor in this election. And Harris, I believe, is going to win the popular vote. But of course, as one of the other panelists points out, this is really an election about 7 states. And I suppose one could argue not about the character of all Americans, but the character of people in those 7 states. Do they favor democracy and robust debate and a society of equality? Or do they want an authoritarian who says he will turn the U.S. military? He said it, not me. he will turn the U.S. military on his own citizens.
Okay, so there are these concern areas, but what about the Indian Americans there? Professor Xenia Bell, 5.2 million Indian Americans in the U.S. It's the second largest diaspora, second largest community of immigrants. How are they viewing it? Is it being driven by the views of Donald Trump, or is it about Save America, as is being said by Kamala Harris?
Can I say something?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question that you asked there, right? Is it being driven by the views of Donald Trump? Is it Save America, as is being said by Kamala Harris? And I think one thing to understand is Kamala Harris is the daughter of an Indian immigrant, raised by a single mother, right? And that's very important. That's a key factor. Like, I'm in several WhatsApp groups wherein Indian women, right, Indian women have come together to support Kamala Harris because, and I'm one of those supporters. I will say that out loud. I'm one of those supporters who's voting for Kamala Harris in this election because, again, I would like to see diversity and inclusion in the White House. That's what I'd like to see. I would like to see more diversity and inclusion and more people of color being elected to power in the United States. And I think it's very important for the Indian diaspora to see somebody who represents, you know, not just Indian Americans, but also African Americans, you know, go to the White House and be the president of the United States. We have not had a female president, right? We've had Hillary Clinton, who's run for president, but unfortunately she did not win, even though she had the popular vote. So it's, I think, one thing to look at is Indian Americans are definitely very excited to see somebody who represents them, you know, run for office, right? Nikki Haley, unfortunately, she did not make it as a Republican candidate, but you know, Kamala Harris has been given the chance, and understandably, she did not win the presidential candidacy of the Democratic Party like how Joe Biden did or like how Trump did for the Republican Party. But it is very important that somebody of color from a diversity and inclusion standpoint be represented like never before in the White House and, you know, be the commander in chief of the United States.
Okay. Nicholas, I have just enough time for you. Your final thoughts about as the world watches as much as America does.
You're asking me
Whether
the world watches as much as America? Well, clearly the world does, because as all speakers have made clear, America matters a lot in the world, whether it is an economic power or a military power or just an influence power. I will just add to what I said earlier that I, for one, have been disappointed by the loss of American influence over crucial wars. And I'm talking particularly about the Middle East, because we expect American leadership and we expect America to do its best to bring these clashes on the Europe-Asian continent to an end. And it hasn't happened. So that's a disappointment. This is not saying that a Trump presidency would do better than a Biden presidency. I don't know. But if we're talking about America's influence in the world, it's taken a hit in recent months. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But for the rest of it, yes, America matters everywhere, whether it be trade, whether it be economy, whether it be the wars I'm talking about, or anything else. So we are all watching very closely. And as I said before, we are hoping to see a clear-cut result and a result that is then put into effect. Because we're not talking about when the votes are counted. We're talking about, I'm thinking about the 2.5 months before the new leadership takes over. And I think that's critical.
Okay. So you're watching not just in the next few days, but the entire period of 2.5 months. I would really appreciate all the panelists for joining us. So thank you so much. We'll continue this conversation over the next few days. So we will be logging on to you all in future as well. Let me bring in Kawal Sibal, former Indian Foreign Secretary. Ambassador Sibal, you know, of course, we have discussed how this election is being watched by the world. For America, again, the question is, which presidency is better? Is it Kamala Harris's presidency or Donald Trump's?
Well, that is for the Americans to decide. We are not players in this game. We have absolutely no influence on the results of these elections. There is the Indian diaspora, which will vote this way or that way, but they are not going to be guided by what New Delhi says. So we are essentially observers and watchers. And what we have to be concerned with is what would be the likely policies of the two contenders vis-a-vis India, and of issues to interest of interest to us, and how they impact on us. Other than that, in terms of going into the minutiae of the elections and the polls and the sentiments of various segments of society, issues like abortion and this and that, these are purely local American concerns. Yes, from an academic point of view, those who specialize in U.S. relations can study all this and take a view on that, especially if you have to give a lecture or engage in an academic debate. But at the end of the day, this is a purely academic exercise, which has no meaning, very little meaning, in terms of the impact of these elections on India and on the international system in general.
Yes. So, but, you know, what do you think Ambassador Sybil led to the decline, and perhaps Donald Trump catching up with the momentum which was there earlier with Kamala Harris? Where do you think the election perhaps shifted in some way?
This again. You see, I've been watching all these debates. You know, one can have educated guesses, you know, people who are looking at America, but you cannot actually replace all the people who are watching the election on the ground, on both sides. I mean, there's a whole group of people in all walks of life, ordinary people, think tanks, academics, press, media, lobbies, corporates, what have you. They are looking at the election very finely and seeing what the trends are, because they are the ones who actually create these trends. It depends on these big tamashas that they hold and what is said there. There is no real discussion on substantive issues. No programs are being discussed. It's all sound bites and rhetoric. And of course, the level of discourse and abuse is staggering in a civilized society like the United States. They're all speaking to virtually committed audiences. And the thing about American election, which you know, which everybody knows, is that there are a whole lot of states which are going to vote the way they're going to vote. Nothing is going to change. At the end of the day, there are 6-7 states which will make a difference, the so-called swing states. And within those swing states, there'll be small groups of people who are going to ultimately decide, the non-committed voters. And the entire effort is to try and win them over. Now, this says a lot about American democracy. And here we have a view, because we are lectured on the state of our democracy and backsliding and stuff like that. But look at the crisis in American democracy, the complete polarization and the sort of things that are said, that the elections may not be accepted. In California, they say you can come and vote without any identity, because if you show your identity card, this will disadvantage the minorities and things like that. I mean, if 100th of this had happened in India, there would be a hullabaloo in New York Times, Washington Post, Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, Le Monde, everything else, how the Indian elections are a farce and Modi is manipulating everything and stuff like that. I think the American democracy is absolutely no example to the world. It is sui generis. It is declining. And in fact, we shouldn't have much hope. Now, look at these two candidates. If America can produce only these two candidates, look at the state of American democracy. I mean, one candidate is hollow. Has no views that we know of, cannot actually speak at any length about our economic policies, about the geopolitical scene. She sort of reads from scripts and she's told to say what she has to say in order to make sure that they lose none of the votes. And the other man is a one-man show, completely unpredictable. And some of the people in your earlier show spoke about his character and his past. And he's the man who says that, who in the past has shown that if the election doesn't go in his favor, he can do anything. And he's been targeted by the Justice Department. That again is a is a commentary on the state of U.S. democracy. I mean, they talk about the Indian judiciary, not being independent and this and that, but look at how the justice system in the United States has been politicized.
Absolutely.
They've done their level best to prevent Trump from fighting this election. And all sorts of charges are against him. Some of the things he had done at the moral level are highly questionable. And he's supposed to be the leader of the free world. And I'm speaking very frankly about this. I don't think we have to worry too much about who wins or who doesn't win, except in the context of the assessment that we make, which of the two will be better for us, and which of the two will be better in terms of resolving international issues which are having an impact on us, whether it's the Ukraine war, relations with Russia, or what's happening in the Middle East, or what happens in U.S. relations with China. And in terms of follow-up on all that has been agreed to between India and the United States under the Biden administration, where a lot of very, very important agreements have been made, especially in the high technology sector, the ICET, IndexX, and also in the defense area, and critical minerals and everything else. Now, we have to see how much of this is followed through. Now, insofar as Trump is concerned, he's threatening that he'll impose 20% tariffs on every country and 60% tariffs on China. Now, we'll have to see whether he'll actually do it or not do it. Lighthizer will probably be Treasury Secretary this time. He's a very tough nut. And we have to watch out what happens. On the other hand, Trump and Modi have a very good personal equation.
That's right.
Trump has been praising Modi very lavishly, at the same time, of course, talking about us as a tariff king. But nevertheless, at the personal level, he does seem to have a regard for Modi. And we have dealt with him for 4 years. And we know who he is, his personality, his unpredictability, and we have dealt with it successfully. Now, finally, at the end of the day, whether it is Trump or whether it is Kamala Harris, they cannot but keep in mind the rising importance of India economically, geopolitically,
absolutely,
and the base of relations that has been created cannot simply be put aside. They have to build on it. Both will build on it, but there'll be problems on the one side, more on the economic side, that is Trump, and on the human rights and democracy and minorities and all that on the side of Harris. So we'll have to deal with it.
Absolutely. We will see how results pan out, and of course the New Delhi will learn to deal with the new regime in Washington. So thank you so much, Ambassador Sibal, for expressing your thoughts on the big fight tonight. That's all from me. I'll be putting out this entire discussion on ndtv.com. Thanks so much for watching. I'll be presenting another episode of the Big Fight next week. Thanks so much for watching.